Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's no secret America has a gun violence problem. Charlotte has one, too. Guns are often easier to get than a pack of cigarettes, and although the Second Amendment assures responsible gun owners the right to own and often carry a gun, it also aids irresponsible people in getting a gun. And it is that second group that is often engaged in wanton violence. After every mass shooting, there are cries for more gun controls to lessen the frequency of those senseless acts of violence, but nothing ever happens. That is due, at least in part, to the work of the NRA, the National Rifle Association. Founded in 1871 to promote and encourage rifle shooting on a scientific basis, the group has since become the most powerful gun rights and lobbying group in the country, but they appear to be on the decline. At the start of this year, they filed for bankruptcy, and the New York Attorney General has filed a lawsuit seeking to dissolve the organization. What impact might that have on the future of gun rights and gun laws? Here to share his thoughts is Tim Mack, a Washington-based investigative correspondent for NPR and the author of Misfire: Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Welcome to the program. Good morning.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Your work at NPR as an investigative reporter or a correspondent focuses on political journalism for the most part, and you've reported on the 2020 election campaign, the Mueller investigation, Donald Trump's two impeachments, the national security, the role of technology in disinformation efforts. How does this investigation into the NRA, which must have taken you a considerable amount of time, figure into all of that work?
Well, you know, I've been looking into the National Rifle Association for a few years now, going back to 2016, 2017 timeframe. It's a really interesting story how I started writing about the NRA. I broke some of the first few stories on Maria Butina. I don't know if you recall her. She's this Russian citizen who got arrested and charged with being an unregistered Russian government agent in Washington, D.C. Now, she was an individual who is a really interesting character, and she's featured prominently in several parts of the book. She's someone who infiltrated the NRA and used the NRA to kind of network in these elite political circles in Washington, D.C. And I was the first one to write about her and get interested in who this person was. And it kind of led me down this rabbit hole to include what's been happening inside the National Rifle Association over the last decade. How did all this corruption bubble up? How did the NRA find itself in such a weakened and vulnerable position today as compared to its apex and the height of its power just a few years ago?
Yeah. And your book, in the course of doing research on this book, you look through thousands of pages of documents that nobody outside the organization had seen prior to your looking at them. And you cultivated sources who told you things, sometimes off the record, sometimes on the record, that they hadn't said before publicly. Why? Why would they give you the papers? Why did they give you access?
It's really interesting. I think the most common reason why people decided to talk to me, I mean, you gotta think of it from the perspective of the sources, right? As an investigative reporter, it's really at the core of what we do as reporters, right? We try to understand why people would be motivated to speak out. One of the core motivations has been that there are a lot of people inside the NRA who are really upset with the executives and leadership at the top of the organization. Now, they retain their original policy stance on guns, but they're talking to me because there's a real issue with transparency and accountability within the National Rifle Association that isn't being dealt with.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking millions of dollars of executives spending on private jets and lavish meals and trips to Europe and the Bahamas, six figures in Italian menswear and suits for Wayne LaPierre, the CEO of the organization. And a lot of people, even some of Wayne's closest friends for many years, decades even, are very angry about what's happened with the direction of the organization. And they're thinking about, you know, the blue collar workers in America who are sending in 5, 10, 15 bucks a month to the NRA, thinking it's going ostensibly to promoting the advocacy they're in support of, but instead it's going to all this other sort of corrupt spending.
Yeah, these are the believers who are doing their jobs because they believe in the organization, and yet they find that the guys at the top of the organization are spending all the money on luxury items for themselves. And you start your book by saying this is a story about how, when it all came crashing down, Wayne LaPierre turned his back on his closest confidants. And carrying a great feeling of personal betrayal, his associates would share their stories to congressional investigators or the office of the New York Attorney General, or to you, the investigative reporter writing this book. So part of the reason they spoke to you because they were angry.
I think that's definitely true, that anger and betrayal are major motivations. I mean, I did more than 120 interviews with folks inside the NRA orbit. I don't think that would have been possible if people, if all was well inside the organization, right? Mm-hmm. That if everything was normal, the NRA was just kind of chugging along prosperously. I think that a lot of folks were motivated because this is a story about betrayal, and it's about disappointment, and it's about greed. The story of what happened behind the scenes inside the National Rifle Association as it all came crashing down is a really compelling one. And that compels, I think, a lot of people to want their stories to be told and to trust that to whether it's me, an investigative reporter, or law enforcement investigators.
The National Rifle Association, as I said in the opening, started in the 19th century as a club dedicated to gun safety and the scientific advancement of rifles. How did it transition from that original intent, essentially a club for gun enthusiasts, to a group that has become feared by people on both sides of the aisle as one of the most powerful lobbying organizations in the country? And one that has had a death grip on legislation that even remotely smacks of any kind of control of gun ownership or gun use. How did that transition happen?
Well, you know, so it's founded, like you said, in the 19th century in New York. And that's going to be actually a little fact that's important later as we get into our discussion that it was founded in New York. But it was founded at a weird time in the 19th century when military strategists weren't quite clear whether or not we should be teaching individual soldiers marksmanship at all, because they were considering military movements and line infantry as a very effective way of marshaling troops for battle. And they were worried that teaching individual soldiers how to fire their weapons would encourage undue individualism that makes the group less organized. Of course, now we realize, okay, marksmanship is important. So the NRA was at the forefront of trying to push individual marksmanship. And for the first century or so, it's really very much focused on outdoor sports, gun safety, and shooting as a recreation. It did not have this hardline view on gun advocacy or the Second Amendment for much of its history. But in the 1970s, in the late 70s, the NRA is considering a shift, moving outside of Washington, D.C., entirely leaving the nation's capital and going to Colorado, emphasizing recreation and shooting sports as its primary motivation. And it's during that year, in 1977, that there's a revolt among the membership of the NRA on the convention floor during the annual meeting. And they kick out a lot of the executives and bring in a new, more aggressive, more politically radical group that begins to dominate the National Rifle Association and sends it on its current trajectory. Mm-hmm. And that's when they decide to focus on political advocacy. And as the years go on, there are a number of other pivot points that we can get into. But that's where it all starts in 1977.
In the 30s, I know that they put out literature to their members to educate them on some gun bills that were passing or being debated in Congress. And then, as you say, in the 70s, they really began in earnest this pushed toward what they have become, and they started a lobbying arm, the Institute for Legislative Action, and later their own political action committee. Why did this group, who essentially took control of the organization, feel it was necessary and that the time was right to do this? Why did they feel there was a threat out there in the country that needed to be addressed by their organization?
It's interesting. I mean, there's always been a diversity of views within the National Rifle Association. But, you know, one thing that's a major theme in Misfire is this tension between the people who want legislative works to be done and the people who are fundraising and increasing the membership of the organization. The people who on the legislative side have typically been more moderate, interested in compromise, right? Because you got to be on Capitol Hill working with lawmakers of all stripes in order to get a bill passed into law. But, you know, on the membership side, on the fundraising side, there's traditionally been a real incentive to sell fear, to say the government's coming after your rights, the government's coming after your guns. And that's been very effective for many years at the National Rifle Association in raising funds and increasing the size of their membership. I mean, it's indisputable that over the last few decades, the NRA has evolved from a small organization to one that now has some 4.9 million members.
I'm old enough to remember where people generally trusted big institutions and organizations to tell the truth. It's only in recent years that we've come to understand that people lie, bald-faced lie, repeatedly. And if you tell the lie long enough, often enough, people come to believe it. It becomes the truth. So my question here, I guess, is the fact when the NRA started this approach to instill fear in its membership and tell them repeatedly that the government is coming for your guns, did they believe that? Or were they telling a bald-faced lie strictly to drum up more members and increase the amount of revenues coming in?
You know, the apex of the success of the strategy that we're talking about is during the Obama administration. And in fact, you know, there's a sort of line that you can draw from the arrogance that kind of bubbles up during the Obama administration within the NRA and the corruption that eventually becomes some of their undoing. It's extremely, the NRA is extremely successful in the wake of, for example, Sandy Hook, this horrific shooting that is really a pivotal moment in the history of gun politics in our country. But the NRA is very, very successful in increasing their fundraising and membership after that shooting by saying to its members, well, the consequences of this shooting will be gun legislation that threatens your rights.
Yeah.
Now, ultimately, that didn't happen, but it certainly did work in the sense of raising money for the NRA and increasing the membership of the NRA. The ironic thing is, though, despite the NRA being so successful during the Obama years, their greatest accomplishment really is the election of Donald Trump in 2016. They spend more money on Donald Trump's election bid in 2016 than even Trump's own super PAC, more than $30 million. And so when Donald Trump is elected, it's this incredible accomplishment for the National Rifle Association.
Did they believe in Donald Trump, or did they believe Donald Trump's policies and approach and attitude toward the NRA and toward guns would be safer for them than that of Hillary Clinton? I only have 20 seconds.
They believed that Donald Trump's policy approach would be safer than Hillary Clinton, but they didn't plan for what would happen after Donald Trump was elected.
Ah, well, we'll come back to that in just a couple of seconds. Tim Mack is here. He's an investigative correspondent for NPR and the author of Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tim Mack is our guest from NPR. He's the author of Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. It's a book that reads like a novel. And it has all the cast of characters that you want to know about inside the organization that has become the most powerful lobbying organization in America, currently going through some significant challenges, posing a threat to their existence, as a matter of fact. So, as you just said, the apex, there we go, the apex of their success as a lobbying organization came with the election of Donald Trump. And they spent more money on the Donald Trump presidential campaign to ensure his victory than Donald Trump's own super PAC did. But they didn't bank on what was going to happen after his election. How so?
Well, like we were saying, the NRA does very well when it's able to say to its members, your rights are under threat. And with the election of a Republican president, there was no threat to sell anymore. And so after the Trump administration comes in, which is what the NRA wanted, what its membership wanted, fundraising goes off a cliff. Membership begins to stagnate. And in that financial contraction, the NRA really struggles. In 2018, things get so bad that the NRA is almost unable to make payroll, biweekly payroll, which, as you know, is a serious, serious problem for any organization. Things get incredibly tight and bad at the NRA. And this leads to another very dramatic scene in the book. Wayne LaPierre, who's the CEO of the NRA, reaches out to an old friend, Oliver North, and asks Oliver North to come on as president of the National Rifle Association. And North agrees. But when he comes on, he realizes something very wrong is happening inside the NRA. North has no problems with any of the policy issues at the NRA, but he realizes that millions of dollars are going out the door in very bizarre and strange ways. So he begins to ask for an internal audit of the NRA's finances. And that's when things really go wrong inside the NRA.
That's something that they did not anticipate he would do. They thought he would be just a good soldier in every sense of the word and come in here and be the figurehead president and inspire people. And yet he did what he does. He's a military guy. He wanted to know what was going on.
Yeah, North was brought on just as a kind of figurehead to fundraise their way out of the problems. But he starts to wonder, where's all this money that I'm fundraising going? And he realizes that something terribly rotten is happening here.
Yeah.
And this leads to this very climactic scene in Misfire in which Oliver North and Wayne LaPierre confront each other in an Indianapolis hotel suite just days before the annual convention in 2019. You know, to set the stage, Donald Trump is expected to speak. Mike Pence is expected to speak. This is the biggest event of the year for the NRA. And in this hotel suite, Oliver North and Wayne LaPierre really get after it on the issue of these internal audits. And ultimately, Wayne LaPierre pushes Oliver North out of the organization and out of his position as NRA president rather than allow an audit to proceed.
Let's talk about the man whose name you've just mentioned several times, Wayne LaPierre. When I think of the NRA, I think of two people. I'd forgotten about Oliver North, but I think of two people. Charlton Heston, because of his comment following Columbine that they will take my rifle or my gun for me out of my cold, dead hands. And then, of course, Wayne LaPierre, who has been the head of this organization for a long time, and a man who has guided its power and influence through Congress and through its membership for a long time. Is he the one responsible for lack of a better term, firearms uber alles attitude at the NRA?
Well, he's someone who's been the head of the organization since the early 90s for several decades. I don't think there's any way you could look at the strategic direction of the organization and not say that he is centrally responsible for the evolution of the group and also for the corruption and the tens of millions of dollars that's been alleged of the group over just a few short years. The book starts in the late 90s with a scene at Wayne LaPierre's wedding. And the ceremony is supposed to begin, and he's not there. Doesn't show up. He spent the previous week telling friends and close associates that he did not want to get married. He's outside with his best man, and the best man says, "Hey, I don't think you should get married either." Puts a $100 bill on the dashboard and says, "Look, we can get out of here if you would like." But Wayne LaPierre gets talked into the ceremony, and it starts in this very awkward and delayed, obviously delayed way. And this weird event occurs where, even during the vows, during the ceremony, Wayne LaPierre can't make eye contact with his bride, and all these NRA luminaries are in the audience watching this bizarre event unfold. And there's a reason I tell that anecdote, because what we really start with in Misfire is this character study of Wayne LaPierre, who's the leader and ultimately responsible for the National Rifle Association. And you talk to people who've known him for many years, and they describe him as this kind of, contrary to his public image, privately, he's a very anxious, weak-willed, almost cowardly person. And folks, powerful people inside the NRA have realized that, just like with his wedding scene, that if you push him, you berate him, if you harangue him long enough, he's going to eventually assent to millions of dollars of, sweetheart contracts for people with close ties to the NRA, or
Yeah.
golden parachutes and the millions of dollars for former officials.
You say his performance at the altar was emblematic of his character, and you describe Wayne LaPierre as a clumsy, meek, spastic man with a weak handshake, at least according to those who know him personally. And you go on to say that he was repeatedly promoted at the NRA despite displaying no sense of professional ambition or charisma. How do you or others explain this rise through the ranks? Because he essentially started as a nobody in that organization.
It's such an interesting character, Wayne LaPierre is. And one thing that he said for many, many years is that he does not want to be the head of this controversial organization, that he'd much rather be the owner of an ice cream shop in Maine. His real dream is just to eat ice cream, sell ice cream, and be among ice cream. And he said that for many, many, many years. It's strange also, like, he's not someone who's really into guns. He's not proficient with firearms, and there are stories where he's downright dangerous with the rifle. In the book, I describe a scene where someone calls out to him while he's holding a rifle, and he swivels around and he points the gun at the person who called out to him. That's obviously a dangerous thing. At NRA HQ, there's even a kind of inside joke that if you don't do well, you might have to, quote, go shooting with Wayne. That's something that people are occasionally threatened with in a joking manner. So the question that you ask, and the question I get a lot, is, so, okay, he's weak-willed, easily pushed around, deeply anxious, doesn't like controversy. How does he become the head of one of the most controversial, powerful organizations in America? And I think that the answer is that because of his malleability, he's proven himself to be indispensable to so many powerful people in and around the organization, whether it's board members who are getting great deals from Wayne LaPierre, or top vendors who have for many years found it really very much in their interest to have someone at the head of the organization to approve and funnel millions of dollars of contracts to them, that he has been able to cement his role there because other people find that there's a real advantage to having him there.
Yeah, he's kind of an odd duck. And you mentioned that somebody says that if you're out shooting with Wayne, the safest place to be is between his gun and the target. Because evidently he's not a good shot. And he was out wild game hunting or something, and he brought an animal down, but he didn't kill him. And then he went close up to shoot him, and he shot him two or three times and still didn't kill the guy. So the guide had to do it for him. You would think, or maybe perhaps he's this Machiavellian character, but as clearly he is not. And the legal troubles he has found himself in are over his lavish lifestyle, Those suits that you mentioned that cost six figures. He has six figures worth of suits from Beverly Hills Rodeo Drive stores. He has the mansion in Dallas and the private yacht, and allegations that he and his wife Susan had bled the NRA dry for years for their own personal gain, while he says no. He didn't want any of this. And it was only through his efforts that worse things didn't happen. Is that still his claim now that this thing has gone, has been exposed for what it was?
One of the major backbones of this book and the investigative reporting is hours of secret depositions in which lawyers question Wayne Lapierre and ask him about a lot of these expenses and a lot of the events that are outlined in over the last 10 years. And so a really common excuse for him in these sworn depositions where he's under oath is he didn't know about it. He didn't know about it. He didn't want it. He didn't want the private jets. He didn't want the mansion in Texas. He didn't want to go to the Bahamas. It was either for security reasons or he wasn't aware. Those are the two most common explanations that he gives. And they're not extremely convincing explanations.
Yeah.
That he needed private jets for security reasons, even when he's not on board the private jets and it's just for his wife and his family and so on. It's not particularly convincing that he needs he needed a mansion in Texas for his own security when, you know, a golf course membership is included in the discussions over that that transaction. So his explanation over time has really been, I didn't know about it, or I needed it for my own safety.
And could there be a scintilla of truth to that? Because you describe him elsewhere in the book when he first came to the NRA as somebody who would go up and lobby legislators in a pair of scuffed up Florsheim wingtip shoes, nondescript, rumpled, pinstriped suits. But then he goes on to buy these expensive Italian clothes on Rodeo Drive over and over and over again. Did something switch in him, or was he pushed by somebody, or like his own wife, Susan, who seems to be a player? I mean, what happened to change? You don't go from being a guy who doesn't care about what he wears or what he looks like to somebody who has to have the best of everything.
A lot of people will associate that change with his wife, Susan Lapierre, who is the bride in the wedding ceremony we discussed, and is very much interested in the finer things in life. A lot of people think that Susan Lapierre is really the big motivation behind that change. And Susan Lapierre is kind of a hidden hand in the National Rifle Association. Now, she is someone who is the head of the kind of elite circle of women donors to the NRA, called the Women's Leadership Forum. And she is a really interesting character who, for all of Wayne LaPierre's flaws, has different ones. Whereas he's weak-willed and anxious, she's very assertive and bold. And she's found over time that, like so many other people who are powerful in the NRA, has found that that if you push Wayne LaPierre and demand Wayne LaPierre approve your expenses, eventually he will. And so when you talk about the spending that's happened at the NRA, you can't talk about it without looking at Susan LaPierre's role.
Yeah. You describe her at the very beginning of the third chapter. Susan is as pushy as Wayne is a pushover. But I think that what you've uncovered and what others have uncovered in terms of the rot within the NRA is not just Wayne centered on Wayne LaPierre. There are other people taking advantage of this. You write about this restaurant in Alexandria, Virginia, on King Street, which is the main drag through downtown Alexandria. The public dining area of that restaurant, it's an Italian restaurant, it's been in business for a long time, and they get a lot. There's a vintner in Italy who makes wines specifically for that restaurant. And downstairs, the public dining area is pricey, but upstairs, the private dining area is even pricier. In 2016 and 2017, you say the NRA paid for 200 meals totaling $140,000. This came out as part of an investigation being conducted by the New York Attorney General. Was the NRA unaware of this? Obviously, Wayne LaPierre must have known about it. Did the members know about it? Who knew about this?
Well, it's so interesting that you bring up this restaurant, right? Because it's a really great case study for how some of these expenses were hidden from the membership and from the public over the years. Now, as a nonprofit, the NRA has a higher level of requirements for transparency and disclosure than a privately held company would. One of the ways that the NRA's top executives would hide their spending from even their senior staff would be to, when they went to a place like Landini's, this Italian restaurant, they would put down the credit card of their ad agency. And the ad agency would pick up the bill and then file it back to the NRA as expenses. So it looked like they were just servicing their client for normal things that you'd expect a PR agency or a crisis communications firm or an advertising firm to do. And by kind of routing these expenses through their ad agency, they were able to hide these expenses from the public, from their members, and even from senior people inside the organization.
And this ad agency, as you write about them, seems to have an inordinate amount of power over the NRA and over Wayne LaPierre, the head of the advertising agency, you write, often in meetings, would berate Wayne LaPierre in front of associates. How do you explain that? Why would an ad agency have that kind of internal power?
This all comes back to Wayne LaPierre's personality, right? The book is really takes readers behind the scenes to being in the room where it happened, where these conflicts erupted. And Wayne LaPierre is easily pushed around. He's pushed around by his lawyers, his ad agency, his wife. In the case we're talking about, even though Wayne LaPierre is the client, Ackerman McQueen, the ad agency, feels like it's empowered to push that person around, to push Wayne LaPierre around. And over a period of time, Ackerman McQueen benefits from the NRA in the tens of millions of dollars. I mean, it becomes a kind of symbiotic PR firm that takes a lot of money from the NRA and its members over the years.
When we come back from the break, I want to talk about the beginnings of the end and the cycle down and what they're facing now and what that may mean for gun rights and for gun owners in America if the NRA were to go out of business, which is what the New York Attorney General wants. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Tim Mack is our guest. He's an NPR investigative correspondent and the author of Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA, which is a really in-depth, deep dive into the troubles that the NRA finds themselves in today and how they got there. And part of the problem you write about with the organization seems to be the way the NRA is actually organized, including its enormous, unwieldy board of directors. There are 76 people on the board of directors, and they offered no direct insight to Wayne LaPierre. And the organization also has various arms that are funded separately and seem to be in competition with each other. You point out the natural friction between the lobbying arm, the arm that goes to Congress and tells people what to vote for and what not to vote for, and whose job it is to drum up support for what the NRA wants. And then there's the membership arm. Their job is to instill fear in the hearts of their membership to give more money, because without them, they would lose their guns. Given that tension, how did they manage to grow and stay so powerful? I mean, they're at direct odds with each other, with no supervision.
Well, one of the things about this book that was so interesting to write about was the factionalism that you describe, right? The inherent tension between these groups. There's an incredible amount of money swirling around,
yeah,
and everyone wants a bite of the pie. And so like you say, there's the fundraising arm, there's the legislative arm, there's the membership arm, there's the arm that's interested in promoting gun safety and shooting sports. And all of these are all chomping at the bit, trying to get a little bit more. And at the center of this is Wayne LaPierre, who is trying to deal with all these competing interests and being overwhelmed by all of the above.
Yeah, the NRA's executive vice president, J. Warren Cassidy, you write, once said it would be a mistake to regard the NRA as a single-issue advocacy group. You should see them as, quote, one of the great religions of the world, albeit a secular religion. If you think that's correct, how would approaching the NRA in that way inform your understanding of the organization, its success, and its failures?
It's not a bad quote, and I think it's instructive in one way, that gun ownership and NRA membership has become, for a lot of people, part of their identity, a central part of their identity. And, you know, especially over the last decade, where the NRA has seen itself not just as a gun advocacy organization, but a cultural organization, what Wayne LaPierre calls a freedom organization, that it's not just about firearms that they're standing between you and the government for. It's about all of your freedoms. And that's the way the NRA has conceptualized itself to its members. In a lot of ways, the reason they've done so is because it's been so successful in raising money for them and increasing their membership.
Following the shootings at Columbine, you write that Wayne LaPierre gave a speech in which he said the NRA believed, quote, in absolutely gun-free, zero-tolerance, totally safe schools. And that means no guns in America's schools, period. That's a quote. Following Sandy Hook, he changed his tone. And in fact, he doubled down on the NPR, on the NRA's approach at the time. He took a different tone, saying that there should be guards, armed guards, in, quote, every single school in the nation. And he argued that if there had been an armed guard on site at Sandy Hook, lives would have been saved. Why the switch?
This is the evolution of the NRA, and at this very pivotal moment where they decide they're going to double down and say, actually, more guns are going to be the solution to the problem of school shootings in America. One of the scenes in the book revolve around what the reaction was inside of NRA headquarters during the shooting and after the shooting. At the time, Wayne LaPierre is trying to figure out a strategy for what to do after this appalling tragedy. And none of the lobbyists are looped in on what is going to happen. So there's this scene of the head NRA lobbyist at the time, Chris Cox, watching on television, totally unclear about what Wayne LaPierre is going to say is the NRA's approach to dealing with school shootings. And hearing this, hearing that the NRA strategy actually will be more guns in schools, armed guards in schools, and Cox kind of lets out an expletive and charges out of the room. He's appalled by the idea. He's appalled by how the NRA is going to approach the situation. But the NRA really does embrace this. I mean, the Sandy Hook is a pivotal moment, not just for the NRA, but also the gun safety movement that's become emergent in this country. But for the NRA, they decided to discard what for a long time has been their most important strategic advantage, which is reaching out to moderate Democrats. After Sandy Hook, they discard that approach, and they embrace only conservatives and Republicans going forward. That works just for a time. But you realize, as we were talking about earlier, that when the Trump administration comes in, this approach shows its flaws, which is that if you don't have any Democratic friends, it's going to be hard to be a broader kind of advocacy organization.
Did they change? Did they embrace Republicans exclusively and jettison the Democrats that they had previously reached out to because they saw the reaction on the part of liberals and more progressive people to what happened at Sandy Hook and Columbine and later at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida, that they knew it was a hopeless cause? Because, as you point out in the book, Wayne LaPierre and several other leaders at the National Rifle Association started life as Democrats, and some of them worked for Democrats. I think that Wayne LaPierre was offered a job in Tip O'Neill's office, turned it down, but he was offered that job. So they were Democrats at heart. Are you there, Tim?
Yeah, sorry. I think okay. We had a brief technical issue here. They were traditionally Democrats. I mean, traditionally, the gun ownership issue hasn't been a Republican conservative issue. It's evolved that way over time. But like you say, a lot of folks in the NRA, in senior positions at the NRA, got their starts in Democratic politics. It's only over the last 10, 15 years or so that the Second Amendment has become a kind of almost exclusive conservative issue. I mean, there are still a couple of Democrats who support the NRA, but it's few and far between. The NRA is part of the issue and their strategic decisions are part of the issue, but there's also, as you know, Mike, been a real polarization of all sorts of issues like this to the point where politicians of all stripes have become more polarized over time.
So as you said earlier, they kind of became victims of their own success with the election of Donald Trump. They pushed very hard for his election. He was elected. And as a result, the fear of the loss of guns on the part of many members or potential members decreased. And so did donations and so did revenues. Then the troubles really begin. In 2020, the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, filed a lawsuit against the NRA seeking to dissolve it entirely. Two questions: why and what jurisdiction does New York have?
Well, you'll remember at the beginning of our conversation, I said the NRA was founded in the 19th century in New York, and that will be important later. This is where it's important, that in the 19th century, the NRA was originally founded there. And so the New York Attorney General has jurisdiction over nonprofits and charities based in New York. So the NRA, when reports of some of this corruption began to bubble up, internal whistleblowers as well as external investigators in the press, such as myself, begin to report about some of the wrongdoing that's happening at the NRA. The New York Attorney General launches an investigation, culminating in a lawsuit, like you say, in 2020 that says that they've identified tens of millions of dollars, over $60 million in inappropriate spending inside the NRA, naming the NRA and other senior officials there, including Wayne LaPierre, personally as part of this lawsuit. Part of the power of the New York Attorney General is that they can dissolve, with the court's agreement, nonprofits that are based in the state. So there's a real possibility that as this litigation continues, the National Rifle Association could be dissolved entirely.
They were already in financial straits when that lawsuit began, but in January of this year, 2021, the organization filed for bankruptcy. How much of that was because of their financial situation versus them stalling tactic to slow down the other suits and that particular one, because that kind of stopped everything for a while? How much of it was a stalling tactic?
Well, the National Rifle Association claims it was never in any serious financial danger, and that they declared bankruptcy actually because they were worried about the New York Attorney General suit. So what the NRA's strategy was that they're going to take the benefits of bankruptcy law, which allow organizations to reorganize, mm-hmm. and move to Texas outside of the jurisdiction of the New York Attorney General. Now, of course, this would set a terrible precedent for nonprofits in America, that if you're accused of wrongdoing by the people overseeing you, you can just move states and pretend like nothing happened. And ultimately, a bankruptcy judge decided that this filing for bankruptcy was not done in good faith and rejected it. And so now
go ahead.
And now we're back in the courts here with the New York Attorney General's confrontation with the National Rifle Association. Mm-hmm.
But a lot of things came out in the course of the bankruptcy hearing. You have people in your book saying things like all the safety switches in corporate governance were turned off at the NRA, that the place was run more like a kingdom than a corporation, Wayne's kingdom, Wayne LaPierre's, and that management is corrupted and the board is corrupted. One board member testified he saw nothing as salvageable. That seems extraordinary to me. And it all seems to lay the blame at the feet of Wayne LaPierre, who was described by one of the board members as not a good business leader. Is this a smear campaign just to put it all at Wayne LaPierre's feet, or are these criticisms justified?
You know, I've done more than 120 interviews with people all in and around the NRA universe, many of whom know Wayne or have known Wayne for many, many years, decades even. Basically, universally, these folks will say that Wayne LaPierre is at the bottom of all this rot, you know, that he's responsible, whether it's his active participation in some of these problems or his kind of passive assent to a lot of the wrongdoing that was happening around him. Folks who are in this world really do say that Wayne LaPierre is ultimately responsible. And how could he not be? He's been the head of this organization for decades. Either he's unaware of things that he needs to be aware of as a leader, or he's been aware of it all this time and allowed it to occur.
And Wayne LaPierre testified at this bankruptcy hearing, and the way you describe it, it was embarrassing testimony. It made him look like a doddering old fool. You describe him on the stand as a, quote, man without discipline, without competence, and without self-control on display for the whole courtroom, streaming live for the world to see. At one point, he admits he doesn't even know his own cell phone number. How do you explain this?
This is a person who, like I wrote in the book, was allowed to continue in this position of immense power because it was so beneficial for him and someone of his character to be in that role. And so now it's pretty evident for people to see. I mean, this is all public, at least that part that you read out, that this was all public, on the stand, people testifying under oath. He was testifying under oath. And we see that the reality does match up with the descriptions made by many, many, many of my sources.
And yet he's still in control of the NRA. The New York State proceedings continue. What kind of world do you see if she is successful in dissolving that organization? What happens to gun rights? What happens to the lobbying efforts of for gun control? Will they simply move a newly named organization to a different state and start over again?
There's no other game in town when it comes to gun rights advocacy in the United States. I mean, the NRA occupies the singular position at the center of it all. No one can compete with them in terms of finances, organizational skill, political power. But if they were to, if you were to have this kind of thought experiment and they disappeared overnight, the millions of members that make up the organization, they don't disappear too. Right. And they're going to continue to be kind of an implicit threat to lawmakers who are worried about their phone lines blowing up, their email inboxes getting flooded. The NRA's future is very important for the future of gun politics in this country, but its disappearance does not mean that the issue is settled.
As we know, Trumpism survived Donald Trump. So the spirit of the NRA and what they stand for, and what they have traditionally stood for in the last 30, 40 years, will also survive the organization if it were to go under. And in the book, you ask how many more millions of members or followers that organization might have had under competent management, or if they were to come under the control of competent management. So the spirit will survive. And how much more powerful do you think they might have been in 15 seconds or less?
It's really hard for me to speculate about that, but I'll say that even with incompetent management, the NRA has managed to grow to millions and millions of members under Wayne LaPierre and his version of the Second Amendment.
Tim Mak's book is fascinating, and as I said, it reads like a novel, but it's true. Misfire, Inside the Downfall of the NRA. Tim Mak, thank you for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.